First of all, thanks for the invitation. I am delighted to be here. This is a talk about asymptotically free gauge theories and their infrared behaviors. Most part of this talk will be based on collaborations with Misha Shipman, and parts of the talk will be based on collaborations with Larry Yaffe and Eric Poppitz. So let me, on the first page, start with a set of famously hard questions. The first question is, consider a zero temperature gauge theory, either asymptotically free or super renormalizable, non-abelian gauge theory. Is there a symmetry associated with confinement or deconfinement? Here, by deconfinement here, I mean a CFD-like behavior at long distances. Can we distinguish infrared gapped, gapless, and CFD kind of theories beyond what we know based on perturbation theory by continuum techniques? And sort of the obvious answer is no, because there is really no symmetry associated with confinement in the microscopic description. So this is sort of the goal of this talk, to make some of these questions and partly some of the answers precise. So let me start with, this is still statement of the problem, let me start with QCD. As we all know, this theory has a very nice property of asymptotic freedom. The gauge coupling becomes weak at high energies, short distances, and there is a new perturbative technology is available here, you know, multi-loop, multi-leg of various kinds. As you go to longer distances, large distances, lattice gauge theory works quite well, but analytical methods are more gloomy. And it is, by lattice simulation, it's shown that this is a confining theory, and it has whole slew of interesting non-perturbative properties. But I also want to remind you that there is a class of asymptotically free gauge theories which in the infrared flows into strongly coupled non-abelian Coulomb phase. So, and one of the purpose in this talk is to understand the conceptual difference between these two class of theories. This is one of our goals. And please, if you have any questions at any stage, feel free to ask and feel free to interrupt.
Just remind me what, maybe a few students, what the word Coulomb phase refers to.
Okay, non-abelian Coulomb phase is, you can, in the simplest terms, think of it as the gauge sector never develops a mass gap, and you can think of this bunch of interacting photons instead of having, you know, color singlet glue ball kind of states with a mass gap. So it is some sort of CFD. Now, this is, of course, QCD. Another class of theories is chiral gauge theories. These are well-defined, and if the matter content is appropriate, they are free of internal anomalies, and they may even have relevance to nature. But typical Largen techniques do not work. Lattice gauge theory for chiral gauge theories is not worked out yet, as of today. String theory did not provide on this class of theories very useful information. And in some sense, one can refer to this class of theories as crazy uncle of gauge theories hidden in the attic. Because they are sort of forgotten, but on the other hand, they may have relevance to phenomenology. Especially, there is a beautiful paper by Dimopoulos, Rabi, and Saskind, which discusses light composite fermions idea based on Tuhoff's earlier idea of about chiral gauge theory. So it may have some relevance. We do not know. This is the second class of theories that I hope to say something about. And also, generically, nowadays, the notion of confinement versus deconfinement is of quite importance in condensed matter physics. They show up in concepts such as, you know, fractionalizations, these deconfined of slave particles, or emergence of gauge theories out of purely bosonic systems. So, and these kind of the kind of techniques that I will discuss here may also apply to high TC cuprates and maybe to spin liquids. Now, so one thing is, we certainly, in order to address these questions, for example, take chiral gauge theories, the statement of the problem also tells us that we certainly need new techniques and new perspective about non-perturbative gauge theory. Let me make a footnote here. There has been quite a bit of progress in supersymmetric QCD, by using dualities, etc., and many people in this room worked on this class of theories, and they are interesting on their own right. But I want to say that the dynamics of theories without elementary scalars turns out to be quite a bit different from the supersymmetric examples, dramatically different actually. In almost all of the examples that I know of, except exceptions really. So I think non-supersymmetric QCD-like theories, either chiral or vector-like matter content, deserves a study of their own. Now, so as I said, we need some new techniques, and let me just mention, as a broad brush, some new ideas that I've been working on in the last 1 or 2 years or so. Let us start with QCD-like theories. Let's say Young-Mills theory on R4, for simplicity, okay? This is, I think it's not an exaggeration to say that it's way too hard. Maybe we can keep locally four dimensions and do not add anything but sort of subtract, compactify one of the dimensions and take advantage of the smallest one, because of the asymptotic freedom, we know that as we go to the compactification scale, smallest one, the gauge coupling may become weak, and we can try to take advantage of the weak gauge coupling, okay? And we can use S1 as a control parameter. But this is not anything new at all. It is the usual common thermal setup of a gauge theory. And in particular, if you are in Young-Mills theory, there is a phase transition from a hadronic phase to a, you know, phase of gluons and quarks where free energy jumps. And if you study this theory down here, it will teach you nothing about the theory up there. Okay? So common thermal setting is not so good for our purpose. We want to be able to study the theory below the confinement radius, so that, you know, we will have some weak coupling, but in this case there's a phase transition, so this will not teach us much. Okay. And this is true actually for any asymptotically free confining gauge theory. This phase transition I mentioned, this melting is maybe bad, but it is unavoidable. It is part of gauge theory, and thermal fluctuations, if you go to sufficiently high temperatures, will melt everything. So hadrons, from a phase of, you know, hadrons and glue balls, you will go to the phase of quarks and gluons. And as I mentioned, one parameter, there may be many parameters, one of them is free energy, and free energy here will jump to be order n square. And here it will be order one, because the spectral density of interesting states is order one in Newton. Now, this just tells us that, you know, if you want to think gauge theory on R3 cross S1, thermal setting is not good. Maybe we should go non-thermal. What does non-thermal mean? In pure Young-Mills theory, it doesn't mean much. In theories with fermions, non-thermal means imposing, say, periodic boundary condition for fermions instead of anti-periodic. That would be a zero temperature compactification. It would be something, if you think in Minkowski setting, it would be a gauge theory, something like R2 comma 1 times S1. Okay? So what is the hop here? In this setup, there is again this S1 circle, but there are no thermal fluctuations, and there are only H-bar fluctuations, and H-bar fluctuations, as this talk will show, are different from thermal fluctuations in a gauge theory. So, in particular, in some QCD-like theories, the analog of confinement-deconfinement type transition, which changes certain symmetry of the theory, is not there. This is a very interesting statement, really, because if you think in thermal setup, there is really no doubt that if you melt things up to sufficiently high temperature, everything, if you heat it up to sufficiently high temperature, it will melt. But what I am feeling here is that if you take this theory, but not put on finite temperature, but zero temperature, and do some spatial compactification, interesting things may happen. The folks familiar with supersymmetry will not find this surprising, because in supersymmetric theories we often apply periodic boundary conditions for fermions to preserve supersymmetry. Actually, there is something more than that. There are examples of gauge theories without any phase transitions, not only confined to confinement, but if there are other symmetries that can change as you go along this S1, there are also disk-loss of theories, which is quite interesting, and it tells us that maybe we can benefit from this setup to learn something about R4.
What is the relevance of periodic versus anti-periodic fermion boundary conditions? I thought it was just the S1
right.
scale that was important.
Right. In the periodic boundary conditions, first of all, if you do anti-periodic boundary conditions, as I said, it's finite temperature and things will melt.
Sure.
If you do periodic boundary condition, it is not guaranteed that, you know, the contribution of fermions can undo the effect of gauge fluctuations. Let me mention a simple example. It is better. Take, for example, N equal 1 super Yang-Mills theory, pure gauge theory with one adjoint fermion. And if you think with periodic boundary condition, it is supersymmetry preserving. And if you calculate the boundary effective potential, okay, for the, for example, Wilson line wrapping this S1 circle, it is identically zero because the gauge fluctuation is precisely canceled by the fermions. So this just tells us that in this case, with periodic...
You're just saying that for a spatial S1, the examples without any phase transitions all involve periodic fermions? Is that what you're saying?
If you do no other deformation at all, that is all the examples which do not break center symmetry are for those with periodic boundary conditions. Mm-hmm. That's true.
Right.
But
there was one other statement. You said that this class of theories, the R2-1, S1, are all zero temperature?
This is zero temperature setting, yes.
So what other parameter... So the expansion of the S1 scale is not a temperature thing in these theories?
Yes. You have to think just as volume, you know, ordinary volume,
right,
instead of temperature. And the goal is to use it as a control parameter.
Right.
That's true.
Okay.
So in some of these theories, the non-perturbative sector of gauge theories, which is really one of the hardest part of the gauge theory, becomes under control. If you go to sufficiently small S1, I will make this much more precise. I will tell you what kind of operators there are, what kind of excitations there are. But this is the magic of this setup. Let me also. Okay, I'll come to that in a moment. As I said, there is a surprising behavior for non-thermal compactifications, these spatial non-thermal compactifications. And these non-thermal compactifications also motivated a new idea, even for thermal constructions. And I will the idea is following. Take, for example, pure Yang-Mills theory or any QCD-like theory. Now, even if you think you can take them in a thermal setting, doesn't matter. And stabilize the broken symmetries by hand, externally, okay? Then you may think that this is a theory different from QCD, but let me tell you what this does. Don't look to these formulas. This is really one of the punchlines of this talk, and Marcus just won't be able to see it. Anyways, let's go to just concentrate on this plot. Let's go to R3 cross S1 and in a pure Yang-Mills theory. Okay. Let's say this is R4, this is R3 times S1 regime, and as I said, there is a phase transition at the strong scale here. Now, the new idea is to add something that I will call deformation of the theory. We will add an operator to the Lagrangian of the Yang-Mills theory, such that this phase transition will either be pushed at arbitrarily high temperatures here, or we will get rid of it completely in a lattice regularization, for example. We can achieve this. Okay, and in this sense, this small S1 regime will become smoothly connected to the large S1 regime. And the large S1 regime of the Yang-Mills theory, not some other theory. And let me just tell you what this deformation is, but I will eventually, I think, come back to this multiple times. This is the setup that I will use quite often in this talk. The symmetry that breaks here is something called center symmetry, and its order parameter is Polyakov loop. You can think of it as an analog of magnetization in spin systems. It's not that important. But that symmetry is broken here and unbroken down there. And you can add in this regime an operator of this kind, and let me first set my notation. This U of X is Wilson line wrapping this S1 circle. Let me draw it for you. Let's say this is S1, and this is U of X, which is path order polynomial of this A4 field. It's the either Wilson line or Polyakov loop, and this is 0 to beta. And you can add a potential to the Yang-Mills Lagrangian. And in this phase, in this deconfined phase, trace U is non-zero. This is deconfined. Deconfined, yes. And trace U is zero in the confined phase. And what this deformation, what this deformation achieves is that it makes trace U equal to zero everywhere, even in the smallest one regime. And let me just tell you what this gets us at the end of the day, then I will come back to the details, okay? With this deformation, the smallest one regime here, which is, it becomes solvable in the same sense as Seiberg-Witten theory by using abelian duality. One can show rather non-trivial, non-perturbative properties such as mass gap and linear confinement. Unfortunately, the region of validity of our long-distance effective theory, which is valid here, do not extend to large S1. This is an important point, so we have no claim for large S1 or R4, but there are no gauge invariant order parameters which does distinguish these two regimes. So there is no reason for them not to be smoothly connected. And there are currently some interesting lattice simulations by Ogivi and his collaborators which show that indeed these phases are smoothly connected.
I'm just asking about this potential. Right. So it's certainly not familiar to me that you can add any sort of potential to Yang-Mills theory. So what is this thing? I mean, I see the formula. I think I know what the terms in the formula mean, but why is this a non-trivial gauge invariant potential?
Because this object trace of U is gauge invariant by construction. U starts and ends up at the same point. It's a line, so it's gauge invariant. And one thing that maybe I should say, this is a non-local operator,
so
right?
N, this is N is a sum over sites along.
Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't. Actually, let me just try for SU2 or SU3. You don't even forget about that sum. All you need to do is just do as this operator. One Wilson line, wrapping this as one circle. That N here, summation here, is for technical reasons. You can forget about that. For generalization to SUN.
This is some generalization.
Yeah, generalization to SUN. I'm sorry. For SU2 or SU3, it's really one operator. For SUN, the generic form of the operator is fixed. All you need to tune is an overall parameter, A. This deformation axis is A. So, you know, if you do, the moral behind this is that if you do a Kolmogorov-Weinberg calculation for the Wilson line, you know, in the smallest one regime, what they do is they generate something of this kind, n equal 1 to infinity, 1 over n to the power, trace u to the power n modulo square, L to the 4. They generate such a potential which is tachyonic for this mode. Okay, this is when you do one loop calculation, you do obtain this result. This potential is designed in such a way that it will undo this effect. Okay, it is the goal. But you can also obtain this potential. I will tell you, but there are theories in which you do not need to add this potential. For example, QCD with multiple adjoint fermions, you don't need it because it comes out to be in this way just by this one loop calculation. It's not strictly necessary. Even in theories, in Yang-Mills theories, you can again obtain this kind of operator by integrating out some massive adjoint fermions. They will also generate this kind of operator. So there is a local, well-defined QCD-like theory underlying this. So, okay. Let me make one more remark. Actually, even though I will not talk about large N, let me just make this remark because I think it may be valuable for Lattice gauge theory. As I said, in ordinary Yang-Mills, there is this phase transition, and if anybody, I know Joe did a lot of work on this, anybody is familiar with something called Eguchi-Kawai reduction from the early 80s, it is well known that Eguchi-Kawai fails exactly because of this kind of phase transition, okay? But now we have this deformed Yang-Mills theory, and it doesn't have any phase transitions. And if you go to large N limits, there is two types of interesting equivalences. It turns out that ordinary Yang-Mills theory and deformed Yang-Mills theory, they only differ by order 1 over n square effects. Moreover, deformed Yang-Mills theory has a volume independence property, which is a working example of Eguchi-Kawai. This is the only working example of Eguchi-Kawai reduction today. So in principle, if you can study this kind of, for example, matrix quantum mechanics at n equal infinity limit, it should give you full non-perturbative data, in particular the spectrum of the Yang-Mills theory. But in this talk, I will not talk about the large N limits. I will only restrict myself to finite and small N. But this is a very optimistic avenue now in Lattice gauge theory. Now, I am just moving back. I want to tell you what this deformation really does, okay? What it does is, if you were to do just thermal thing, you know, without the deformation, you would have this U, as I said, is something, some Wilson line of this form, and it has some eigenvalues. It is an n by n matrix. And if you were to do some typical thermal calculation, this tells us that we have to, the minimum is at u equal 1, which tells us that all the eigenvalues of the Wilson line are at 0, all n eigenvalues, okay? They are all clumped. And when you add that deformation, and I'm sorry, just for reference, for example, if this is the case, and if you put here beta to 4, and if you evaluate this sum at the minimum, you get here n to the m, something like minus n squared t to the 4, which is the usual Stefan Boltzmann law. Just to get back to high school years, this is nothing surprising. With this configuration, you do obtain usual Stefan Boltzmann law for gluons and quarks. As I said, when you add this deformation, you sort of change the saddle point of your action such that these eigenvalues, which were sort of attracting each other, just repel one and another. Okay? You can think these as the eigenvalues of either this Wilson line or A4. So what happens? This is some sort of a Higgs regime where eigenvalues are maximally apart. And in some sense, this A4 field behaves some sort of adjoint Higgs field. Okay, it plays exactly the same role as an adjoint Higgs field. And if you are familiar with old Georgi Glashow model and Polyakov model, you would immediately realize that there will be many interesting non-perturbative phenomena which is under control here. Okay, so this is what this deformation buys us at this stage. This configuration of eigenvalues at which trace u is equal to zero and eigenvalues are at the roots of unity, they are maximally apart from one another. Now, what does this mean, really? If you go to, think for example in terms of beta function of this gauge theory, okay, this may be deformed gauge theory or some other, and first remember the beta function flow for the theory on R4. But now, what happens is that if we start in microscopic theory, let's say with some SU2 for practical purposes, at this scale 1 over L, this adjoint Higgs field generates a gauge symmetry breaking down to U1. Okay? So, and if you are in this pure Yang-Mills theory, for example, other than the photons, there are no other light degrees of freedoms in the theory. So the gauge coupling, the four-dimensional gauge coupling, will be what it is at this scale.
I lost track of what theory you're talking about. What is the fundamental theory?
Let's say this is Yang-Mills theory, this particular theory. Yang-Mills theory with some deformation, okay? But this whole discussion is quite general. It also applies any QCD theory with adjoint fermions.
Why is the symmetry broken at the radius?
Ah, good. As I said, remember Georgi Glashow model, for example, if you have a scalar which has a wave of the form A1 up to AN, right, and if these AIs are not equal, let's say AI is less than AJ, then this induces a gauge symmetry breaking, right, SUN down to you want to n minus 1 for at large distances.
So this Polyakov loop is doing that.
Polyakov loop is sort of playing the role of an adjoint Higgs field. And there is a massless photon, or in this case many massless photons generically, but in the case of SUT only one massless photon. And okay, let me also identify this phi for you with A4, which is this Wilson line. The only distinction relative to the Georgi Glashow model here is that in the Georgi Glashow model, the adjoint Higgs field is algebra valued and it is non-compact. But in our case, this A4 field, the Wilson line is a compact group valued object. The distinction being, if you align these A1, A2, so on and so forth, A3, up to AN. This is one case, and in our case, all these things are on a circle. Let's say A1 starts here and AN here, A2. And this will show up later, but as an interesting aspect, there is a extra topological extension in the theory with compact adjoint Higgs fields relative to the theory of Polyakov. It will be quite important, but it's somehow a technical point, but the moral is really hidden here in these two plots.
I have another question. I'm confused now that which symmetry are you talking about? This is the case where the eigenvalues hang around 1 is the case where the center symmetry is broken, and when they're spread out is when it's unbroken. So
right. Center symmetry, in this case, center symmetry is unbroken.
Right, so okay. Which symmetry is broken that you're talking
Gauge
about?
Gauge symmetry. But Gauge symmetry are not truly ever broken, but that's just to say that at long distances, the light degrees of freedom, this is just temporarily gauge variant description, but as you go to large distances, the only massless modes are photons. So in this case, 3U equals 0. In this case, 3U not equal to 0. What I'm saying is that in this case, when the eigenvalues are apart, center symmetry is unbroken, but there is a gauge symmetry which reduced to a maximal abelian subgroup at large distances.
We can see that from what you said?
Is
this just an assertion at this point?
Sure. If you just insert this wave, vacuum expectation value to a gauge kinetic term, for example, d mu phi modulus square, it will immediately show you that if you a mu has some component ij, it will be ai minus aj square aij modulus square. So it will generate mass for all none of diagonal elements. For all W bosons, you will have a mass term. But for mass for photons, diagonal elements, AII components for photons, you will have massless degrees of freedom. Okay. Now, so as I said, so at this scale, because gauge symmetry breaks, there is only photon. And if you remember Seiberg-Witten theories, this is very similar to that. In their case, there's a moduli space, and at some distant point in moduli space, gauge symmetry may break similarly.
So just to make sure I'm understanding, you're saying that if you just take SE2 gauge theory on a spatial S1 with nothing else, that the theory at very long distances, large compared to 1 over L, just has photons?
Exactly, with that deformation.
With
deformation, it only has photons. But, okay, what does that mean? Does that mean that infrared theory, in perturbation to all orders, that means there's only a free photon? But the interesting question that Polyakov asked maybe 30 years ago is that, maybe more, is this perturbative fixed point destabilized non-perturbatively? This is a very important question, and in order to answer that, I will first make some digression to the Polyakov model. It will be really elementary, not very much. Consider, for example, let me just remind you, abelian duality and Polyakov model. Consider just free Maxwell theory on R3, okay? This is dual. And in three dimension, the photon only has 1 degree of freedom, so same as a scalar. There is some duality relation, but photon is same as free scalar in 2+1 dimensions. And for free Maxwell theory, again, the masslessness of this dual scalar is protected by a continuous shift symmetry of this kind. And you can describe this free theory in one of these two ways. And if you calculate another current in this dual theory, it is just a derivative of this dual photon, which is nothing but, in a Euclidean setting, a magnetic field. So the conservation of this U1 flux current implies that there are no magnetic monopoles in this system. Okay. This is just free Maxwell theory. We know that it remains free non-perturbative. But if there are magnetic monopoles in the system, then this current will not be conserved. Okay? So there will be monopole operators that will be generated. Many years ago, Polyakov showed that the effect of these monopoles is the insertion of these operators, exponential I sigma. This exponential I sigma, you know, times exponential of S naught generates a monopole at point X. And in this way, you see that if you expand sigma around its minimum, it just generates a mass gap for photon. So there is really no massless photon anymore. You show that the system has a mass gap of order of exponential of S naught divided by 2. In this formula, S naught is the action of the monopole, and it's actually something that you very well know. It is the relevant quantity in our case will be exponential of 8 pi squared divided by g squared n, which is precisely the quantity that shows up in the one loop renormalization coupling beta or renormalization group beta function. It is certainly easy to understand the physics of this. For example, the physics is not really nothing more than Debye mechanism that we know from statistical mechanics. If you assume there are many monopoles in the system, monopoles proliferate, and assume you put a large Wilson loop, there will be a current on the Wilson loop, and it will generate a magnetic field in the z direction. But there are magnetically charged particles all around, and they will just come and screen. This simple physics argument gives you precisely the area law for this theory. And one point that I want to point out is that this system has a discrete shift symmetry rather than a continuous symmetry. And if continuous symmetry were there, that would forbid any monopole operator. Okay. Now, this is a gauge theory without any fermions. Okay. Now, I want to say something about a QCD-like gauge theory with fermions. In particular, I want to say something about QCD adjoint, two flavors. And remember this form of the monopole operator first. The main distinction in a theory with and without fermions is that in a theory with fermions, the monopole operators have many fermion zero mode insertions. Okay. You don't need to understand everything in this transparency, but I will just tell you the important points. Okay. The monopole operator is not exponential of S naught times I sigma, but it also has a certain number of zero mode insertions. These are sometimes called Rebbe-Jakiev zero modes. Okay. And if you were to think, okay, just monopole operators, that wouldn't generate a mass gap for gauge fluctuations, because these would generate multi-fermion photon operators, and it wouldn't be satisfactory. Now, let me just point out that in a system I have in mind, there is a discrete shift symmetry, which is some discrete axial symmetry, and that symmetry transmutes to the dual photon, something of this form. So an operator of this kind are allowed. So there may be a photon mass, but it's not due to magnetic monopoles, something of a different kind. Symmetry tells us that there must be operators of this kind. Can we understand them? Can we understand how they form? The interesting thing here is that if we normalize the magnetic monopole charge to be +1, this object has charge +2. It tells us that whatever this object is, it must be somehow a composite of two monopoles with the same charge. This is at first counterintuitive, because these things repel each other by Coulomb force, right? But there is something really extraordinary in this QCD vacuum, QCD adjoint vacuum. As I mentioned, there are also these fermion zero modes, and there will be some interaction because of the exchange of the zero modes, fermion zero modes. And it generates a logarithmic interaction, logarithmically attractive interaction at large distances. And there is this very interesting notion of pairing in this gauge theory. So indeed, such excitations which carry only magnetic charge but no fermion zero modes externally are there in the vacuum of this gauge theory, and they generate mass gap for gauge fluctuations.
So, I mean, I understand that if you have an operator
certain quantum numbers, you should have a state with that quantum number, but why do you expect a particle or an object with that, a degree of freedom with that quantum number? That's a different thing.
Right.
Like in, you know, QED, I have things of charge, states of charge
good.
10.
Good.
10 electrons, but I don't have, they don't have a charge 10 field, so.
Very good.
Yeah.
First of all, symmetry tells us that this is there, right? You also agree with this.
Yeah.
The question is whether dynamics allows them to be there. And my argument was, if you think in this gauge theory, there are, you know, there are some objects with some, you know, zero modes, etc. Some monopole operators of this kind. What I am saying is that, you know, there will be other, let's say, I named them here BPS and KK bar, they carry the same magnetic charge, but opposite topological charge and opposite index. This has certain chirality and this has the opposite chirality, something like that. All I am saying is that these such objects, there will be an attractive interaction. There will be first 1 over r repulsive Coulombic interaction between them, and there will be a logarithmically attractive interaction which depends on number of layers, number of permeable layers here. And at large distances, this will overwhelm that 1 over r, and there will be, you know, sort of composites of this kind. And this is sort of leading object which may generate a mass gap in the system. There is no other subleading in the exponential of SNAP, non-perturbative expansion. There is no subleading object which may generate a mass gap in the system. So they must be there in that sense. And dynamics tells us that they are there. I will actually show you somehow a more exotic object in a chiral gauge theory. But really, the point that I want the audience to get from this transparency is that there may be some different topological excitations in the gauge theory vacuum that we did not come up so far. One thing I must emphasize, this, which is very important. Notice that the topological charge of this object is zero. So it is indistinguishable from the perturbative vacuum in the in the topological sense. This is what makes very hard to see this object, you know, or what made it so sort of elusive, because it's not. It has the same quantum number in the sense of topological charge. It has the same quantum number as the vacuum, as the perturbative vacuum. So. And these objects are there, and you can write the long distance theory, and the dual formulation of QCD with two adjoint fermions is written on this line. This is my photon. This is this effect induced by magnetic pairs, magnetic bions, if you wish to call them that way. There are fermion zero modes, and there are interaction between fermion zero modes and the photon. Marcus, you also asked the distinction between thermal and non-thermal case. Remember that here it is most transparent, so I want to make a remark on that. Remember that in the non-thermal case, we give anti-periodic boundary condition for fermions, so that means there are no zero modes by construction. They are all lifted, fermions have mass of the order of Matsubara frequency, which is temperature. But in this case, by periodic boundary conditions, there are fermion zero modes. If they do not get lifted quantum mechanically, they are always there. Okay? In a thermal setup, you never see fermions in the long distance description. In this theory, fermions are part of the game in the long distances. They are there and contributing to dynamics non-trivially. Now, actually, I want to make one more remark. The same mechanism of these magnetic bions is also true in N-equal 1 square angles, but this is not understood before, although there is much literature on that. by many people. But the philosophy that people arrived to long distance description of the super anneals was different. They just obtained the monopole operator, then they asked the question, what is the supersymmetric completion of this? Here, the question that I am asking is different. I am saying there must be a bosonic operator, and it must be, it shouldn't have any zero modes. So what is its physical origin? So even though this dual description of n equal 1 super anneals was known by work of many people, but you know, also via Seiberg-Witten curves, F theory, M theory, blah blah, field theory, and especially by a good work of Holobutta and Kose, I think its physical implication was never understood. And it's the same physics with QCD adjoint. And again, the magic bullet is not supersymmetry, but is unbroken center symmetry. Now, for QCD-like theories, I can say much more things, but I want to move on to a class of theory where not much is known. I want to give you an example of chiral gauge theory. As you know, chiral gauge theories are, as I mentioned in second transparency, they are well defined, you know, in this particular case, I will tell you about some SU2 gauge theory with three-index symmetric representation fermions. You may say, who should care about this theory? But I don't know. It may have some relevance, but understanding the chiral dynamics is of prime importance, as I mentioned earlier. First, the standard model is a chiral theory, but it is weakly coupled. Maybe we should be thankful for that, otherwise we would be in trouble. But let me just say a few words on this theory. It's well-defined, it doesn't have any Witten anomaly, global anomaly. For I equal 1/2, there is a global Witten anomaly. And there is no framework, dynamical framework, to address the dynamics of this particular theory. And everything that is known about this theory is actually on this page. It has some U1 symmetry, but the instanton operator is of this form. It has 10 fermion zero modes, instanton operator. And the action of the symmetry on the fermion is just like this. And other than this, nothing is known. The supersymmetric version of this theory is much more famous. Intrilegators Seiberg and Schenker wrote a paper saying that if this theory, supersymmetric version, confines, it is the simplest example of dynamical supersymmetry breaking. But whether the theory confines or not is not clear. It's controversial. And my understanding is that now it doesn't confine. But I just want to talk about non-supersymmetric theory, and I will come back to the supersymmetric one if there are questions about it. So this is the body of knowledge about this theory. And what can we do? We can again, oh, by the way, the technology for chiral theories is developed in a paper, in a joint paper with Misha Schiffman, but the dynamics of this particular theory is a joint work with Eric Popitz. In particular, he asked me this question about particular dynamics. You can similarly work out the monopole operators. There are two types, again, BPS and KK monopole operator. And this BPS operator, this M1 operator, has 4 zero modes. This second operator has 6 zero modes. Notice that the product of these two is an instanton, and you have 10 zero modes here. By the way, the calculation of these four sort of either takes 4 weeks or 4 months, depending on your pace. But thankfully, the relevant index theorems are now worked out by Eric, so we know that 4 is true. Now, let me make some interesting observations. First of all, I mentioned in the previous transparency that there is a Z10 symmetry, which is a symmetry of microscopic theory. And that Z10 acts on this site 4 in this fashion. And since it's a genuine symmetry, monopole operator must be a symmetry. Must respect that symmetry. It tells us that if monopole operator is respectful to that symmetry, the dual photon must have a Z5 discrete shift symmetry. Okay? So what does this tell us? This tells us that any operator of the form cosine q sigma, where q is not equal to 0 mod 5, any pure flux operator of this kind, which can generate a mass cap for photon, is forbidden. The first non-trivial operator is something of this kind. And it is allowed by this Z5 symmetry. The interesting thing here is that, again, it was in the previous transparencies, this discrete axial symmetry, Z10, transmutes into this dual photon as a Z5 symmetry. I will say something rather non-trivial about it momentarily. Okay? So we have this operator, and we can again repeat your question, ask, you know, what generates this operator, or is there anything which may generate this operator? Because it is a bosonic operator. Indeed, there is a very interesting object, a magnetic oddball in some sense. If you take 3 BPS monopole and 2 KK bar monopole from the previous page, each BPS has 4 zero modes, and each KK bar has 6 zero modes of opposite chirality. You can soak up the zero modes of this guy by the KK monopole. So you have this very interesting composite, which is just merely generated by fermion zero mode exchanges. And this object, whatever it is, it generates a mass gap in the chiral gauge theory. I am sorry, this looks like W, but you can always flip it and make it an M. There is actually something very interesting in these duality transformations on R3 times small s1. In all the cases we have studied, in all the examples, the questions about dynamical chiral symmetry breaking in the original microscopic theory always translates into spontaneous breaking, symmetry breaking by a three-level potential, which is the simplest kind of symmetry breaking in the dual description. This is the fate of all discrete chiral symmetries. Now, these bosonic potential, in these bosonic potential, they are always induced by some topological excitations, and those topological excitations, almost all of them were unknown until last year.
I want to make sure I'm getting the big picture. So
sure.
This is a theory, again, where you are stabilizing this... and you're looking at the center symmetry, and you're looking at the system at distances much larger than the radius of this.
Exactly.
And you're claiming there that you have this mass gap.
Right.
So in that theory, in that three-dimensional theory, just below that the one over R scale, this theory is abelian or non-abelian?
At long distances, it is abelian.
It's abelian.
All these examples of confinement are abelian confinements.
How does this abelian theory get a mass gap? I mean, just sort of from, I have to say that I don't understand. Okay, these objects exist. So what? If they are just some massive states,
good.
I wouldn't call that a mass gap because they don't give the photon.
No.
What is their crucial property?
In this case, they are finite action configurations, and they just proliferate the vacuum because they are finite action. There are many, many of them. They are dilute, but as you go to very
this
long distances,
like the,
there are many of them.
Like the Abelian-Higgs model.
Precisely.
The instantons break.
Right. Right. So in the long distances, if these monopoles are, or the other excitations, bions or this magnetic quintet is relevant, then you must get confinement.
And again, this only tells us about the R4 theory if there's some result.
If everything is smooth.
Yeah.
Right. And that's not shown at all, and I think it can only be shown numerically. But now I want to say a few interesting things, hopefully. All these theories I mentioned has monopole instantons. And the question I want to ask, is the mass gap and confinement, mass gap in gauge sector, is it inevitable? So at least the intuition of 70s, beautiful intuition, I must say, by many people, Tuhoff, Mandelstam, Nambu, Polyakov, is that this should be the case. When you have monopoles, they should induce some sort of mass gap. But there had been known to be some counterexamples, but I want to say that all these interesting possibilities, gaps, ungapped, interacting CFD, are possible despite the presence of all these topological excitations. So what's the key? So in particular, the types of theory I have in mind for is that theories in the conformal window, we know that on R4, Banks-Zaks type theories, they are also asymptotically free, but they flow to interacting conformal field theories in the infrared. At least in the weak gauge coupling, we can make this precise. So assume we took one of those theories, okay, one of the theories in the Banks-Zaks window and discussed in this setup with this deformation. Surely it will have monopoles, but what will happen? This is the question that I'd like to answer. So take a particular case in which this topological symmetry is nothing. It's trivial symmetry. That means all the operators of this form are allowed. The interesting question is, can a monopole operator whose classical scaling dimension, the prefactor here, which I didn't write, is +3, become irrelevant in the renormalization group sense as you go in the presence of massless fermions? This is the question. If so, if these monopole operators become irrelevant, then you will surely get massless gauge fluctuations, because in this setup there are only two ways to give a mass gap for gauge fluctuations. One of them is Chern-Simons term, which is parity odd, and it will never be generated in vector-like theories of this kind. The other is this dual mass term, and if the dual mass term is due to an irrelevant operator, then you will get a massless theory in the infrared. And if so, then there will be a continuous shift symmetry, which will tell us that monopoles are not there, essentially. They are diluted away to zero. And if this is true, this would be a non-perturbative conformation of both Banks-Zaks or lower portion of conformal window. Okay, you can do a renormalization group analysis. This is a transparency, which just to show that I did some calculations. You don't have to understand everything. There is this electric coupling, okay? Because of the Dirac quantization condition, if we know the renormalization group flow of the electric coupling, we also know renormalization group flow of the magnetic coupling. There is this, I just symbolize the topological operators, you know, fugacity by this zeta hat, and there is also a renormalization group flow for that. And it is this equation in particular, this coupled set of equation, determines relevance versus irrelevance of the topological sectors of a gauge theory. And this calculation is for SU2 theory. Don't count me very accountable of the number, but the result is extremely suggestive and interesting. This is the final result. For fugacity operator, monopole operator, it turns out that if NF equals zero, for example, this is a highly relevant operator in the infrared. Pure Yang Mills, it will confine, good. If NF equals 1, 2, 3, things seems fine, and there will be confinement again in a similar manner. But there is something very interesting. When the prefactor here flips sign, the monopole operator becomes irrelevant, and the most likely scenario in the infrared is a CFD. So, and if the sign is negative, then that means relevance of monopole operators. We all know, for example, the distinction between an asymptotically free theory and infrared free theory, right? Let's say this is asymptotically free, let's say this is energy, and this is infrared free. This suggests that there may be, this calculation suggests that there may be a similar plot for topological operators. And for let's say take asymptotic free theories, and in confining theories, this monopole operator confining is relevant at low energies, and the monopole operator becomes irrelevant for, if monopole operator becomes irrelevant at low energies, it's a CFT, conformal field theory. There may be a precise analogy in this sense. And of course, the control over this calculation is provided by S1 circle. So one cannot really take this and literally say anything sharply useful for R4. But one sort of gains some intuition what should happen.
Did you do this for your J equals 3 halves theory?
No, I only did for SU2 because it's a bit of a hard calculation.
I mean, it's not just this NF isn't just some index of the representation or something, so then you could just plug in
right
for the SU2 with the J equals 3 halves. Is that actually, I think if you just guessed based on the conformal window
right.
for the beta function, I think
right.
it would be conformal.
For J equals 3 halves, non-supersymmetric theory, I think it is sort of strongly coupled. So one cannot really deduce something by studying beta function. But for supersymmetric example, what you are saying is correct. There is a fixed point at weak coupling for supersymmetric example.
No, I'm not saying at weak coupling. This is
right.
I'm just saying if you just, you can't, this NF doesn't just become the index. And if you were to repeat this calculation for the J equals 3 halves theory, naively I might think this NF is just the index of the matter at
I think so, yeah.
With the same coefficient A, then you could see whether it's
one needs to check it. I'm not sure.
And the 2 becomes NC. Anyway.
Okay, I think I will skip, I think I'm out of time, right? So I will skip part of it, but actually the fact that quantum scaling dimension of these monopole operators receives corrections proportional to number of flavors was also discussed in condensed matter literature. This is of work of many people, but and it turns out that and the most interesting paper here is this Hermle-Santin. It relies very strongly on this paper of Kapustin about the scaling dimension of monopole operators. And it turns out that these questions are of some interest in frustrated spin systems. I can tell you why, or if you are interested, I can also tell you in private. If I tell them to you, it will take 10 more minutes. So I can either go directly to the conclusions.
Maybe we'll people who are interested will discuss the problem.
Okay, I will skip this spin system discussion. Let me just finalize with two transparencies on necessary and sufficient conditions for confinement versus deconfinement in gauge theories. As I said, if there is a continuous U1 flux symmetry, this U1 star is really U1 flux, which forbids the monopole operators, this is sufficient to show the absence of mass gap in the gauge sector. If U1 flux symmetry, you know, this U1 symmetry breaks down spontaneously, then photon may become a Goldstone boson. I didn't mention any example of this kind in this talk. If U1 star is unbroken, this topological symmetry, which is the continuous shift symmetry of the dual photon, is unbroken, it protects the masslessness of the photon non-perturbatively. So the most likely infrared behavior is really a CFT in this case. This is most likely to be relevant for conformal window of QCD. Now, the more interesting case is that the cases in which there is only a discrete topological symmetry. In this case, this discrete topological symmetry is necessary but not sufficient to exhibit a mass gap and confinement. If the monopole operator or other flux operators of this kind become irrelevant at large distances, then there is an accidental continuous topological symmetry emerging in the infrared, and this class of theories will generically deconfine and will flow to some CFTs. I misspoke in the previous transparency. This is the class that QCD with many fundamentals may belong. I'm sorry. But if the monopole operators are relevant at large distances, then the mass gap is inevitable. Confinement will occur. Showing the relevance of the monopole operator here is the sufficiency criteria to show confinement. In these four categories, there are examples actually of all four categories. This I did not mention, in this talk. QA, I mentioned this Bank Z type QCD star theories applies. And QB is really Young-Mills star theory, this deformed Young-Mills theory, or QCD, which is deformed QCD theory, and the intuition about this 2B category is really goes back all the way to 70s to the work of many people. Okay. I'm sorry. Okay. I think this is all I would like to say for the moment about these theories.
So the fact that these things are, at least in simple cases, you say there's lattice evidence that there's no this recoupling phase and the strong coupling phase are connected. Is there any reason to think that that's general? I mean, everything you're saying is sort of based on that.
No, it's not general, actually. But the alternative is also interesting. You may know that many people in the past talked about confinement without chiral symmetry breaking in QCD. And when I'm saying chiral symmetry breaking, I am referring to continuous chiral symmetries. Okay? And in multi-flavor theories, actually, that is, in small S1 regime, you may indeed have confinement without chiral symmetry breaking. And as you go to large S1, there will be just a single chiral phase transition, but you will still be in a confined phase. So you will see these two types of confined phase. In one-flavor theories, there was only a discrete chiral symmetry, and in that case, discrete symmetries can also break at weak coupling. But for continuous symmetries, I think a strong coupling for Goldstone bosons of that kind, strong coupling is necessary. But I think the alternative there, the presence of confinement without chiral symmetry breaking is maybe more interesting than, you know, at least equally interesting as smooth connection.
Do you mean the topological excitation? What do you mean topological excitation? Topological excitation?
Right.
Is that their ground form? Or?
The topological excitations here, in the dual description, you can think the dual description as a many-body system of topological excitations. If you think Euclidean, you can think, you know, many monopole operators, but there are really a variety of them, you know, ones with fermion zero modes, ones without zero modes, you know, and it is really a very strongly coupled many-body problem, and purely described in terms of topological excitations in the dual description. And everything in the dual description, actually, interesting things are all sort of like simple three-level. Mass gap is, for example, like a three-level effect, or discrete chiral symmetry breaking looks like a three-level effect by a potential.